So I'm going to talk today about the basics of myelodysplastic syndrome. This is essentially the same talk I have with my patients when somebody first comes into my office with a new diagnosis. And I always find it helpful to understand the process of what's going on to then understand what's directing some of our therapies or our recommendations for therapies. And I do come here from a Cleveland Clinic Foundation in Ohio. So what will I talk about today? First, just a quick definition of myelodysplastic syndrome so we're all on the same page. Yes?
Since you were kind enough to produce
the
PowerPoint for us,
yeah. The PowerPoint is in everyone's packet. Thank you. So you don't have to take notes unless there's something astounding I say that's not in the overheads. Thank you. So I'll talk a little bit about the definition of myelodysplastic syndrome first, go over some basics of the bone marrow, go over MDS in the bone marrow when the factory doesn't work, some different subtypes of myelodysplastic syndromes, and then some rationale for therapies. I know there's going to be another session on Saturday where some experts are going to be going over some of the therapies in more detail. So I'll give you some of the rationale for it and mention a couple of therapies, and I'm certainly happy to entertain questions afterwards, but I won't be going into detail about every therapy. First, a fairly simple definition. Myelodysplastic syndrome is a heterogeneous clonal hematopoietic disorder derived from an abnormal multipotent progenitor cell characterized by a hyperproliferative bone marrow, dysplasia of the cellular elements, and ineffective hematopoiesis. Now, this is what every doctor in the country is taught myelodysplastic syndrome is, and frankly, I can't understand it based on these definitions. So let's try to redefine it in English. It's an abnormal bone marrow stem cell that gives rise to other abnormal cells. Stem cells are grandfather or grandmother cells, or Adam and Eve cells in the bone marrow. They are the original cell in the bone marrow that gives rise to other cells that wind up in the bloodstream, and something has gone wrong with them. These abnormal cells grow quickly and crowd out the normal bone marrow cells, which die and fail to make the usual blood components, red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. And fairly typically, myelodysplastic syndrome is diagnosed either when somebody complains of being tired and it turns out he or she is anemic, the red blood cells are low, or on a routine blood test obtained for another reason altogether. Maybe you're going in for some surgery and somebody draws some blood and discovers that your platelets are a little bit low or your white blood cells are a little bit low, and a further evaluation leads to a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome. One slide on the history of MDS just to put us in 2004 in context of where we've been. The first published report of an instance of myelodysplastic syndrome dates back to 1913, and the first literature review of 143 patients with MDS to 1973. When you see something that says a literature review of 143 people, what that means is somebody went through all of the published reports of any disease and was only able to identify 143 people before 1973 who had myelodysplastic syndrome. Now, does that mean that the incidence of myelodysplastic syndrome is increasing or we're getting better at diagnosing it? The answer is yes. The first classification system was in 1976 and revised in 1982, and that was the French, American, British, or FAB classification, and I'll go over that in a little bit. And then the World Health Organization, or WHO, came up with its own system in 1999, and there was another publication in 2001, and that's probably the more accepted classification system these days, though it's a work in progress. Let's go over some basics of the bone marrow so we all know what we're talking about. I'm going to use the mouse pointer as my pointer here. This cylinder that I struggled to draw on this slide is supposed to represent your bone. The inside of it is the bone marrow. Everything outside of this is the bloodstream. These are those stem cells I was talking about. Now, stem cells can do a couple of things, and I'm obviously oversimplifying this, but I can only understand things if they're really, really simple. So this is how I think about it. Stem cell does a couple of things. It makes a copy of itself, a perfectly identical copy, and then it makes some kids. In this case, I've made, had it making two kids. Those kids then do the same thing. They make a copy of themselves, and they make a few kids, and so on and so forth. It's like that old commercial for Pert shampoo where you tell two friends and so on, and all of a sudden everyone knows something. You have a whole population of cells that has derived from a single stem cell. As you go through each subsequent generation, these cells become more and more mature. I think of it as they're going through primary and secondary school and finally leaving the bone marrow to either go to college or to make a living. And we should all be so lucky with our kids. What they eventually wind up making are the red blood cells, the white blood cells, and the platelets. What is it those cellular components of the bloodstream do? Well, the red blood cells carry oxygen to the tissues. The tissues require oxygen to function. Tissues can be heart, liver, kidneys, anything you can think of in the body. It requires oxygen. This red blood cell gives its oxygen to the tissues and then goes scavenges some more oxygen from the lungs. The white blood cells are our immune system. They go ahead and they fight infections. In this case, I'm showing the white blood cell engulfing an infection, a bacteria or a virus. When your white blood cells are low, it means your immune system isn't functioning well. In other words, you're somewhat immunocompromised. And the platelets help stop bleeding. I think of them as corks that flow through the bloodstream. When you have a cut or a wound, these platelets rush to that cut or wound and plug it up so that you don't keep bleeding. When the platelets are low, you develop bleeding problems. And those can be kind of nonsense bleeding problems, like you bump yourself and you tend to bruise a little more easily, so they don't really affect your life. Or they can be more serious, where every time you brush your teeth, you start bleeding, or you have internal bleeding. So now let's take another look at a bone marrow that has myelodysplastic syndrome in it. We have those original stem cells. It's still making a copy of itself. And when it goes to make its kids, it makes, let's say, a normal kid, but something goes wrong when it makes this kid. And remember, these cells are making identical copies of themselves. So this kid, this myelodysplastic syndrome cell, makes an identical copy of itself. You have another myelodysplastic syndrome cell. That process continues. And what happens in the bone marrow is these cells, which were supposed to make red blood cells and white blood cells, are now making myelodysplastic syndrome cells. Now, I use red blood cells and white blood cells just as an example. It could just as easily be a cell that makes platelets. There are still a few cells in the bone marrow, however, that are functioning normally, and they will go on and make, for example, platelets, or they might make white blood cells or red blood cells. It's a little more complicated than that, though. These myelodysplastic syndrome cells also release chemicals called cytokines that run over here and affect these normal cells so that these normal cells start to die out also. In this case, the picture I've painted is a little bit bleak, but somebody has what we call pancytopenia, meaning that they have low blood counts in the red blood cells, the white blood cells, and the platelet lines. This is the basic theory behind myelodysplastic syndrome and why it's so difficult to treat. You have two processes going on that are at opposite ends of the spectrum. You have a cell that's growing too much, and you don't want it to grow that much, and it's a bad cell. And you have cells that are dying too quickly, and you don't want them to die too quickly because they're good cells. So if you think about this logically, do you want to give a drug that promotes growth to get the good cells working, or do you want to give a drug that stops growth to get the bad cells from dying too quickly? I mean, to prevent the bad cells from growing too much. Let's take a step back, just give some background information. The incidence of myelodysplastic syndrome in this country is impossible to define because we aren't keeping track of it here. So we extrapolate from some statistics we get from the United Kingdom and from the European Union. We estimate that approximately 5 per 100,000 people in the U.S. will be diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome each year. That translates to a number that's somewhere between 12 and 20,000 people. That would make this, if you were to call this a leukemia, and I would not, but if you were to lump it with the leukemias, because docs who treat leukemia tend to treat myelodysplastic syndrome, it would make it the most common leukemia. That once you hit the age of 70 years, that incidence increases to 22 to 45 people per 100,000 U.S. citizens, and this is, again, believed to be underestimated due to underdiagnoses. The number of cases in the population is increasing. There's a growing number of older adults. I don't know if you know this, but in the year 2000 census, there were 35 million people over the age of 65 in the U.S. That number is going to double to 70 million by the year 2030. This is a disease of older adults. It's only going to increase. Doctors are becoming more aware of myelodysplastic syndrome and therefore are being more aggressive about diagnosing it. There are increased toxic and chemical exposures that are causing myelodysplastic syndrome, and it is not considered a pre-leukemia, though you may have heard that term before. Fewer than one-third of people diagnosed with MDS progress to frank leukemia. In broad strokes, there are two types of myelodysplastic syndrome. There's what's called primary or de novo MDS that develops in people with no known exposure to MDS-associated chemicals, and the most common ones cited are benzene derivatives or organic solvents. And then there are secondary or treatment-related MDS. This results in people who are exposed to certain chemicals that include organic solvents, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy. Yes, we are causing some MDS. The more people you look around at who are cured of breast cancer and cured of prostate cancer, you have to remember there's a certain minority of those people who also develop myelodysplastic syndrome because of the treatments they've been given. And secondary or treatment-related MDS occurs about 20 to 30% of the time. So let's look at the first classification system. There's nothing magical about classification systems. I just wanted to read through the names so that you've heard it, and then I'll tell you how I think about it. Within the French, American, British, or FAB classification, this is the one that was developed in 1976, there's refractory anemia with ringed sideroblasts, refractory anemia with excess blasts, refractory anemia with excess blasts in transformation, or chronic myelomonocytic leukemia, also called CMML. We often think of refractory anemia and refractory anemia with ringed sideroblasts, these two up here, as being early MDS, RAEB and RAEBT as being a more advanced MDS, and then CMML is a bit of a mishmash. It can fall into either one of the first two categories. Just to look at the distribution of these subtypes, refractory anemia affects approximately 28% of people diagnosed with MDS. Refractory anemia with ringed sideroblasts, 24%, RAEB, 23%, RAEBT, 9%, and then CMML, approximately 16% of people. Moving on to the World Health Organization, comparing the FAB to the WHO depends on whether you're a lumper or a splitter. The WHO is more of a splitter, so they'll tease out a couple of different diagnoses for every one that you saw in the French, American, British classification. The most important distinction between the World Health Organization and the FAB is that CMML, that one that I called a mishmash before, is now an entirely separate category because it is a mishmash. Their acute myeloid leukemia is now defined as somebody with 20% myeloblasts in the bone marrow, those are leukemia cells, or greater. In the past, that would include people who had the RAEBT classification. And then there's another group of patients who have what's called the 5q minus syndrome as a distinct entity. What that means is if you look within the myelodysplastic syndrome cells at the blueprints for those cells, the chromosomes or genes that guide how those cells are going to function, some people will have an abnormality of the fifth chromosome. It's called 5q minus. One other system you should hear about is the International Prognostic Scoring System, which was developed in 1997. This is a method of predicting survival based on three characteristics of any person walking through the door. The first are the percentage of blasts in the bone marrow. The second, the degree of compromise of blood counts. Do you have an isolated low blood count, such as an anemia, or do you have two, meaning an anemia and a low platelet count, or do you have all three, a pancytopenia? And then finally, the cytogenetics, those genes or chromosomes in the cells, those blueprints for the cells, contain different types of abnormalities. Some people have no abnormalities, some people have what we would call good risk abnormalities, and some people have what we would call poor risk abnormalities. And this is my system, the Keep It Simple Secura system, because all that's too confusing. So I divide it into low-grade MDS or advanced MDS. In low-grade MDS, what predominates are the death of normal cells. Normal cells are dying too quickly. With the advanced MDS, what predominates are the growth of the abnormal cells, those myelodysplastic syndrome cells, and the death of normal cells. So now we get to the rationale for therapies. To review, MDS is complicated because good cells die too quickly, bad cells grow too quickly, and bad cells make chemicals called cytokines that make the bone marrow an inhospitable environment for good cells, and that encourage the good cells to die too quickly. So, to treat MDS, medications should do all of the following. First, they should stimulate good cells to grow. An example of that would be growth factors. If anybody out there is getting any Neupogen or Procrit, those would be examples of hormones that are stimulating the good cells to grow. We have to stop the bad cells from growing. That would include 5-azacitidine or Vidaza that was just approved by the FDA, decitabine or arsenic trioxide, also known as Tricinox, or stop the effects of the cytokines on the good cells. And an example of that would be lenalidomide, which is the new generic name for Revlimid, which has just finished up a couple of large phase 2 trials in the country. We should be getting the preliminary results from those sometime this year. In summary, MDS is a disorder of the bone marrow that results in inadequate production of red blood cells, white blood cells, and or platelets. It can be subdivided into low-grade and advanced subtypes. And therapies for MDS target the factors promoting the growth of bad cells and the death of good cells. So thank you very much. I think we're going to take questions after we're all done. Is that right?
Dr. David, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.